The Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule. And for today's episode, I wanted to make a little interlude, I guess, in the series to celebrate International Women's Day. And I was racking my brains about who I was going to speak to for today's show. And suddenly, I had the inspiration to ask or re-ask a wonderful guest that actually turned me down in the past. Disclaimer. And sometimes persistence pays off. So we're sitting here in the art studio of a very lovely artist. And Romani's paintings are a product of the inner work that's been developed every time she picks up her brushes, which are evident all around the room that we're sitting in, as well as her artwork. I've been to one of her exhibitions about 3 years ago at Cantashado, and I was absolutely transfixed by the stunning artwork there, which I felt was kind of deeply infused by nature and inspired by nature. And I would say that's probably connected to the other work that she also does as a firefighter on Ibiza for Ibanat. So we're going to talk about both of those themes today and the kind of, you know, the weaving of those two worlds that collide together in such a beautiful way through her artistry and through her connection to the land of Ibiza. And for me, I think that's kind of a pretty inspiring story to dig into, because I think, you know, you'd have to be a pretty strong woman to be involved in kind of getting involved in the firefighting service here. So Romani Sanchez, thank you so much for saying yes here on International Women's Day.
Thank you. Thank you for coming over. And yeah, the time is right when the time is right. So now it is.
Indeed. And I'm definitely not offended. I think, you know, if the time doesn't feel good to be talking about certain things, you have to have your boundaries in place. And I think that's all part of, you know, being a strong woman and kind of knowing when you do and you don't want to be doing certain things in this lifetime. But, you know, let's start off with the firefighting, if you don't mind. I think it's like, you know, very intriguing. I've not met a female firefighter before. How did you get involved, or what made you kind of want to join the fire service here in Ibiza?
It was actually kind of by chance, because I had come back from living in the States and I was looking for a job, and I went back to being a waitress somewhere to kind of support myself. And somebody who I know told me, hey, there's some opening here for working for the IBANAT, which is Instituto de Balear de la Natura, which is also working for the natural parks. And I didn't really imagine it was just going to be firefighting. I thought, oh, it sounds nice. I'll be working with the natural park, as Salinas and biodiversity. And I thought, that's great. And so I went for the job interview and they took me, which was... And then we had to do these physical trials, and we were trained for like 10 days or something. And so they trained us. And I think this is when they were opening up, which was 2001. And they were wanting more people to come on board because there weren't enough people. It was kind of like a different kind of organization before. And so I did the first summer kind of like just as a experience, and I really loved it. And so in the winter, they also were taking on people to clear the forest. And I really liked it, and it combined very well with my artwork, because I've always wanted to be an artist, but not to live from my art. Because if I had to try and make a living from my art, and this comes through being brought up by artisans, market artisans, I thought I would always be making things that people wanted. And I wanted to do art. For me is more like an inner journey of knowing myself. So actually I wanted sort of to have my finances looked after with a job, and to be able to paint whatever I want and not to be painting as a livelihood. And so it worked out really well, because I'm also a very physical person. I like physical activity, and this was really physical. And then it also gives you a lot of free time. So it was kind of suddenly I fell into this perfect combination of doing a lot of physical work. So if I worked in winter, I would work from 7 a.m. until 2 with machines, working in the woods, clearing the forest. And as soon as you come back, you're, oh, everything is like aching, and you have a shower, and then I go in the studio and paint all afternoon. And it was wonderful. So I didn't have to worry about, you know, making money or living from painting. And that gave me a lot of stability, mental stability, to explore my other side. And so it was a perfect symbiosis. So I stayed there for a few years, and then I dropped out for, I was also into traveling. So really, because I was never a fixed worker, I used to take contracts and then not take contracts. It's like, that's the way it worked. So it also worked that sometimes I wouldn't take the job and I would go traveling. And so then when I didn't have enough money, I'd go back and work. So it seemed like the perfect kind of job for all that.
What was that like? I'm assuming there weren't that many women in the fire service, and maybe I'm assuming completely wrongly, so feel free to correct me. But, you know, what was it actually like in terms of working in that fire force of mainly men?
Surprisingly wonderful, because I didn't have any issues with, I mean, of course, there's some men that are a bit macho, or, but I never felt ever, and this is something I've said so many times, I've never felt like second best because I'm a woman, or that they have to do a favor because I'm a woman. There might be like the odd incident with an older person living, working in my job, who comes from another generation maybe. But in general, there's a great respect, and you are expected to do equal. I mean, which is great. And there are very few women, actually. I mean, for years and years, there's only 3 women and there's about 65 people working in the job. So, and I wasn't there for 10 years, so there was only 2 when I wasn't there. And those 2 have been ongoing, kind of the same amount of time as me. And then there have been other odd people who've come for like a summer and didn't continue and it was too much, or they had another kind of life, or they went on to do something else. But to actually stay in the fire brigade, there's only 3. And so this summer was we were very happy, the girls who were working there, because we've been 6, suddenly doubled. They took on more people because other people have gone back to live in Mallorca or have changed. And so the women on the list came in, and there was a very nice atmosphere, and they're very fit. And we did a lovely race in San Carlos at the end of the year, you know, one you go through the mud and together, we dressed up as fire.
I think they call it Tough Mudder in England. There's like a real crazy one where it's like an assault course.
The Extreme de San Carlos, I think it's for the Fiesta de San Carlos we did, but it was fun. So we felt there was a good team going.
I mean, you say it was a very physical job. I mean, going out, clearing the forest. I mean, absolutely hats off to you. That's like the kind of work that really needs to be done, particularly at this moment in time when we haven't had any rain for God only knows how long, or any decent dump of rain for a good length of time. I think, you know, how strong did you get from doing that job? How did you feel to be kind of like as fit as a fiddle through doing that kind of work?
Actually, the first winter that I spent in the forest, I can say that my little t-shirts that I wore in summer, the tank tops didn't fit my arms anymore. They strangled my arms. So something happened in my back and it never went back to my old shape of being fine.
You were just like bulging biceps, properly hench.
It just became big and it's never gone back. But yeah, it is, but you can also, you have to use your brain for this work. And I think that's part of it. I mean, there's a lot of physical work. You've got to be fit. You've got to have a lot of, in Spanish we say fondo, like you've got to be resilient. And like for fires, when you work in a fire, you get strength, you don't know where you've got it from. I mean, imagine with the equipment that we have to wear, which is anti-fire, which is heavy. You're carrying like 20 kilos of hoses up a mountain, not on a little pathway, through branches and everything, and in an inclination that goes up. And with heat, sometimes it can be 40 degrees in summer, blasting hot. So sum all that up, it's pretty tough when that happens. you can train, but you can't train enough for that, because we do have our trains. We go running. We do marchas montaraces, which is we sort of go for walks, like heavy walks with the weight on and up mountains and things. It's sort of like slightly kind of like a military training.
So it sounds hardcore, like proper full on.
Yeah, but I enjoy it. The fittest kind of, we have some people who are athletes and some people who smoke all day and they also drink and whatever. And sometimes you'll be surprised that even the people who seem less fit, they've been in there for years and they have such a good ability with their mind of how to sort of, for an emergency, work. And what I really enjoy about this work is the teamwork. You have to trust who you work with and you work as a team. So in a fire, there are many different aspects you have to be aware of. And you have to look after yourself, but you also have to look after the rest of the people who are in you. And you've got to be aware of orientation and where the winds are coming from and where the fire's going and the planes that are attacking the front and the helicopter who's dropping off water. You've got to be aware of a lot of things. And I love that sort of strategy of seeing how things work.
It's absolutely fascinating. I guess there are things that you don't necessarily consider until you're out there in the wild kind of forest. And it's a very rugged, ragged, rustic, quite terrifying place to be, I'm sure, when there's like a rip-roaring, raging fire tearing through the mountains. I mean, actually, 2 years ago, I did an episode on wildfire. And last year, I did the alpacas for Earth Day. And the year before, I interviewed...
I heard the one of the fire.
Anna de Gaune, and a wonderful man, actually, from Ibana. I can't actually remember his name, which is absolutely terrible. But his father actually died in a fire in Mallorca. And it was like, you know, I guess when you join a fire service like that, you don't necessarily consider the prospect of a seriously major fire kicking off. I mean, obviously that is on the table and it is so, so likely in this current scenario of just, you know, one cigarette butt. If you're driving across like that little road from San Juan to San Vicente, for example, could happen. But, you know, when that actually crops up, that's a really huge moment. And as you said, it's not something that you necessarily can train for or prepare for, but in the moment, it's just there and it's got to be tackled.
I would like to highlight something, actually, because people only see fires when they're ragingly big and when they're sort of cutting off roads or it's spectacular or there's fear. Every single fire starts with a tiny little tiny place. And like last year, we were going out daily putting out fires and everybody said, oh, there's nothing going on. Really, how strange, we don't have any big fires. Because, and yes, we do get fires, but we got there in time. And there's such a difference in getting there in time than it actually starting to take off. I mean, there's a big difference. So I think we have to not underestimate the small little descuidos, you know, like someone can have dropped something and they're not always man-made. I mean, it's just because someone has thrown a litten butt out the car or they've been smoking in a camping. There's loads of things that have happened through the camping and because we have the situation here where housing is so expensive and you've got to be so careful. I mean, I'm not against living wildly, but there are so many risks if you're living in the woods and you have to make your food and or use smoke or, you know, there's so many different things that can happen.
I think it's interesting though, because often I see fire and I think, oh my God, like that doesn't look safe. And that could, you know, one gust of wind and that could really cause something quite major. And I think, how do you know? Or is it annoying for you to receive phone calls about these piddly little fires that are probably quite self-contained or on a farm or a farmer's got his eye on it? Like, does that happen a lot?
Usually in summer, we all go out to whatever because it's completely prohibited to do fire. So, but in winter, the actual forestales, the guards, they will go and sort it out and see if there is a risk. And if there is a risk, we do go and put it out. But if not, we don't. In summer, it's completely prohibited. But this winter, it's been completely prohibited as well. Mm. And people have kept on burning, thinking they could, because they haven't made enough warnings. I think they should have made a lot more warnings.
Interesting. I think, well, as you said, I mean, no one wants to be the little boy that cried wolf, but I think ultimately sometimes you just think, oh, that just doesn't look good. And sometimes I feel like, oh, should I call somebody? Like, it's just very difficult to know. I mean, obviously the very famous fires that we did talk about in that particular episode 2 years ago were, you know, the Benaras fires and the fire of San Juan. And, you know, I think actually the land has just about recovered more or less around that neck of the woods these days, because I go hiking around there quite a lot. But, you know, it took more than a decade for things to vaguely return to normal. I mean, you were obviously on the scene during the Benaras fire. And I mean, how was that when you first got that phone call to understand, I guess, the scale perhaps of what was unfolding? Because that was the first big one that we've seen.
Well, we actually had two biggish fires the years before. Charaka, which actually Benaras fire got into the one where Charaka had burnt, and another one in that area. But Benaras was the biggest, because it just went out of control once it got to the top of the mountain and hit the back. We were there from the beginning, there were a lot of circumstances that were a chaos, total chaos, because there were so many people on the beach, because there were so many people walking through where we were trying to work. It was complete chaos to begin with, and this noise of the explosions of the cars, they weren't exploding. It was actually the glass that was bursting with the heat. So it makes this bang, this big bang. But of course, you don't know that. You're working like in the Torrente and you hear this sort of bang and there's fire everywhere. And we couldn't get the lorries of water on time to begin with. And then it was starting to get dark and the helicopter can't fly after it's dusk. And so it has to be done before. Anyway, there were lots of chaotic things that happened to begin with, which made it get out of hand. And then it was out of hand. And it lasted for 3 days.
I mean, did you work for the whole 3 days nonstop? Was that just like, right, no sleep until this is over?
Well, we can't do that. But before, there were not so many regulations as now, which this is why, since I've come back to Ibanat in 2021, I like the way it's organized much more. I mean, they learned a lot of things through these big fires that we've had. But also things have got better with the working rules now. So before, if we had a fire, sometimes we could have been like almost 20 hours in a row or 15 hours in a row working. So in that fire, I got there about 5:30, I think, when it started, and I didn't leave until 1 o'clock in the morning. But then I had to be back at 8 o'clock in the morning. So it just, you got home, had a shower, and were there again. And then you were there for like all the day. And then that might be about sort of 15 hours. And then you go home, have a shower. And so, yeah, I was in there for the day shifts.
I mean, how did that feel, like, to see something of that sort of ferocity in, you know, your island where you grew up?
It's sad to see. There are many aspects as well that I think, I would actually like the forest to be regenerated in a different way once a fire goes through it, because there are natural ways of making like barriers so the fire doesn't go actually why we get so many fires is because the forest is not managed anymore. It's not productive. And because it's not productive, no one can be bothered to clean it. So it has so much brush, underbrush. It's so unlooked after that just anything will ignite it and it will, you know, flare up. But I think if we used the forest as for carbon or for all the uses that it used to have, it wouldn't be so easy to light up and it wouldn't go so fast. So there is an aspect of, it's sad. It's very sad. It's scary for the houses that are living there. It's scary for us who we work with the fire. But actually, I remember looking down the valley like on the third day and we were looking for hot spots that we have to put out, and it was sort of smoking. It was the big fire was out. And actually seeing the architecture of the mountains that I hadn't seen before, because it's just full of pine trees, and you could see the beautiful stonework of the terraces and things. I'm thinking, why don't we recover it? Why do we have to leave it with pine trees again? I mean, it would be wonderful taking the advantage of this tragedy. You know, the parts that had the terracing were actually gardens. I mean, they had fruit trees, and they were separating the mountains naturally, because they're canals where they would collect the water, and that's where they'd have their fruit trees. So why don't we recover that system? And then we wouldn't get, you get a fire that wouldn't go further than the little bit of ploughed land. So I remember thinking there was a beauty in the tragedy, that there was, I could suddenly see the mountains in a different way. It's sad, but I also knew, for instance, there, that it was going to regenerate immediately, because it was an older forest, like somewhere that has just burnt not long ago, and the trees are not over 7 years old. You would have to replant them, but this way the pine trees replant themselves.
They're very resilient, these monocultures.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we've just added, you know, Ben Dunwell's magical book, you know, Pine Tree Island, and you know, this island, the Pertusis, I mean, that's, you know, it's named after really the one tree that seems to grow here and has grown here for so many, many years. It's kind of, you know, and they kind of explode apparently when they go on fire. Is that true? Mm-hmm. So they just bang, they just explode.
Well, they have a lot of resin in them, and yeah.
That must be also quite intense to be in amongst it when that's kind of going off around you.
It's, I mean, when you say explode, it goes like up in flames quickly. Explosions would be, for instance, it's another aspect that happens when a fire, it eats up all the oxygen in front of the fire, and it will just explode up, which is, that happens when there's a lot of combustion and there is no oxygen in front of a fire, and it flares up. That's an explosion in a big bushfire.
I mean, but were you even slightly scared in that scenario, or did you just have your kind of teammates by your side and feel like you had a very steady attack on things?
Scared is not the word when you're actually working there, because we're not working on the head of the fire, we're working on the perimeter. And the head of the fire is dealt with the Canadairs that come and take water out of the sea. And you cannot be near them, because if once they throw the water, the big trees just go snap off like little matches. So you cannot be next to where the Canadairs are. They're attacking the front, and we're attacking the sides, making it not go up. So we don't actually see the fire that's happening at the front. We are working our way around, going up and down with hoses, connecting hoses. There's a lot of going up and down mountains and securing the area that so it doesn't. The other thing is, you can get fuegos secundarios, secondary fires from places that are not well put out. So we have to keep sort of containing it.
A lot of gesticulation with the hands there, but no microphone. Yeah. You have to keep containing it.
So scared, you know, when it's happening, there is something that is just, you are working and you can't think, and you just, you don't think in sort of that, you can think of it afterwards. I don't know how to explain. It's like you're actually just working out each little riddle as you're going along, like this needs to be done, that needs to be done, this, but you're not thinking of the day. I mean, of course you've got to be, like when I go into an area, I have to know that where is the secure area if the winds change, where do I have to evacuate to. There are things that you're constantly aware of for your own safety and for the safety of the people you work with. You're sort of, that's the kind of things you're dealing with at the moment of each sort of instruction that you get. So you might get a boss that says, you know, go up here and do this, and I'm going to also make sure that what they're telling me is coherent, and if it's not coherent, I will also say, I don't think that's right. And, you know, or tell me, where is the secure area?
As a woman, I saw that your birth date was 1976. I hope you don't mind me saying that on a website I was reading earlier about your biography on the Saatchi Art Gallery pages. And I was thinking, so she's only 1 year older than me. And like, what age do you think that you'll be firefighting until?
I don't know. When I left Ebanat in 2010, I thought, actually, I think I'm not going to keep doing this for the rest of my life. It's too hard and whatever. But don't know. I got into running about 10 years ago, which I wasn't super into running before. And so I don't know. I don't feel unfit for it at the moment. And I don't think it's, I mean, this is another thing that we are working for in our I can't think of los sindicatos,
the syndicates.
Yeah, because people should retire early from this kind of job, like the bomberos, the ones who could do accidents in cars and buildings. They can have an early retirement because of the danger that they've been through and the
trauma
and the trauma and the hazardousness. So is that the word?
Like danger.
No, you also inhale a lot of fumes, and there are lots of things that
toxicity
that you shouldn't be exposed for so many years. So we're also fighting for the same kind of rights for forest firefighters. And I think it will come.
Intrigued. And what do you think, you know, if you're doing all the restoration work as well and you know, trying to clean the forest and obviously take away, as you said, all the kind of little bits and bobs that make it so easy to spread, what's the solution? Like, particularly in this moment in time that we're experiencing of extreme drought and water crisis, like what work needs to be done? You're saying that no one's really doing anything. No one's cleaning the forest anymore. No one's really putting any effort in. What is happening and what needs to happen?
I must say that these couple of years, more people are doing more than they have done since I've seen this kind of work. The thing is that when I say that they're not using it anymore, I'm talking about like since the 1950s till now. I mean, because when tourism came in, people abandoned the countryside. So when you see photographs of like the 1940s in Ibiza, you'll see that the forest was worked, that they used it. But since tourism came, it was not worth it anymore. You could just, you know, have a hotel or by the sea and you make a lot more money. And why are you going to break your back in the forest and making charcoal? And so that's what I mean. But there are many more people who are aware now and people who are looking after their woods. And I think there's more of an education. I think people gradually are starting to be aware of the danger. And there are many more campaigns that are also telling people to really, you know, you have to clear the forest 30 meters around your property because we spend a lot of our capacity looking after houses. I mean, I remember in the Benyras fire, we were looking for the hot points like when the fire was over and when people could return to their houses. We went to this place and this German man has a little house on top of a hill and he has a little wooden terrace and everything. And he said, oh, wow, it's incredible that my house is intact and it's completely burnt around me. And I said, do you know how many helicopter water deposits your house needed? You know, it's not a question because we have to look after the properties first and then people and then you look after the woods. So if your house is not well cleared, we spend a lot of our recursos, our capacity in looking after your house. And meanwhile, we can't divide our attention so much. So I think it's very fundamental that people are responsible for their own pieces of land. And there are many more help from the government that you can get now, and they will. You can get some money from the government to do it. So you have to do the investment, and then you get paid. It's the other way around. But
of course, this is Ibiza. Nothing comes for free. No, I mean, it's fair enough. And I had Peter Lehner from Black Nose Wines on the podcast as well. He was also involved in that San Juan fire, and he said, you know, when he got back and he obviously flew here directly from Switzerland, I believe, where he lives. And, you know, he was obviously petrified that his house had gone up in smoke. And he said, you know, the morning after he woke up, he opened the front door and there was still the burning embers, you know, right up to his doorstep. And I think it was a real close shave. I mean, I can't imagine how that must feel to have a house like that and to feel like, you know, it could have been a real close one. But, you know, that's not your priority at the end of the day. You've got to protect the people and people's property, I guess, is not quite so important as lives and saving the forest.
Yeah, there are many places that are in a great risk here. I mean, I could name you quite a few urbanizaciones that are in great danger because of all the little woods in between. Siesta is, I mean, I hope it never goes up in flames. You have to look at the inclination of a mountain, the apartments on there, the way that the woods are intertwined inside of the buildings and the streets, and there is continuity. So there's so many places that are a high risk, and Ibiza, on the San Jose Road, there are many places that have loads of houses in between. I mean, you look at the way that they're living in the woods. It's so dangerous, but until it happens, people are not aware of it. And I lived in California. I've got many friends in California. Some friends lost their house completely there.
Ibiza's
smaller. We can get to places easier. I mean, it's different than California or the States, which have great extensions. I think we should be more aware.
His name has come back to me, Aniol. That was him. Do you know him, Ibanat?
No, I didn't know the person, but I think that must have been someone who was working in the 10 years that I wasn't there.
No, I just wondered if you knew him. Suddenly his name came back into my mind. I was just like very moved by his story. I think, you know, one of the things that stood out in your art exhibition in 2021 when I came to Cantashado, which was an amazing exhibition and I'd never seen your artwork before or didn't really know what to expect, was the Tree of Possibilities. And I wonder, you know, obviously you're literally spending all your time, as you've just explained, in the forest. So how did this piece of artwork particularly come around? I'm quite intrigued because it was quite a large dominating piece in the exhibition.
Well, a lot of my art... Well, it's kind of symbolic. It means other things. I represent things through images that are organic and about nature. And trees seem to be very, very prominent in many ways. And they have different meanings. I kind of like, because I never know what's going to happen when I do a painting and then the meaning comes afterwards. So usually, because I'm a sort of a thinker about, I kind of want to work out things. So there's usually like a center of gravity question in my brain knocking me around for a while I'm painting that. So then sometimes the what I was investigating gets intertwined in the meaning of the painting. So with that painting particularly, it was during a time where I was trying to delve into abstract art. And for me, I did a process of walking in different ways of seeing, which is another long story. But I was actually going on walks, trying to not understand what I can see with sort of white noise in earphones. and when I got back, I would just try and paint without thinking and write without thinking. It's a kind of like an abstract, surreal exercise on the brain. And so I did this experiment for a whole year on myself. But when I was doing the abstract painting, there's a part of me who always tries to conclude, like I work from smudges and I see things in smudges and I turn them into that. And then once there's something here in the painting and something there, then the relationship between those things are what comes to the meaning of the painting in the end. But because I was very frustrated with this abstract approach where I was trying to not conclude things, not turn something into something recognizable, I was trying to sort of have another exercise of control on myself, which would be to not always go into the easy part and sort of see something and make it. Just define it, but not turn it into something. Just leave it open for interpretation. So in that frustration, I had this other very big painting going in my bigger studio that I had before, which was then the Tree of Possibilities. And I had done this enormous tree. And so I just would go in and do these little tiny phases. I could see in all these little sort of smudges, I could see phases. So I just was always getting my frustration of not turning something in the other one, turning it into this one. And this tree, well, a lot of my friends around that time, I was hearing stories. Some were kind of like, oh, I've had kids and I've done the whole thing, like this sort of midlife crisis. Some of them had kids, done their career, they were like happily married or not happily married, but they'd done everything that they had to do, and they were sort of saying, goodness, what have I left with? My kids are leaving home now and I'm bored with my business or my job, or I don't get on with my husband anymore, or just we'd have nothing in common. Or then I had on the other side friends who had led a kind of more normal life, kind of say, and who maybe hadn't had kids, hadn't had a partner, hadn't have been traveling around or doing sort of freelance things, and they were coming to us a crisis, telling me sort of like, oh goodness, like I haven't had kids and I haven't had a normal job, and look at me, I'm almost 50, and what am I going to do with my life? I've just been, I think you had all those experiences that these people want, these experiences who haven't had. So I was sort of putting two and two together. And so I had this idea that I was going to work on, I mean, because I'm somebody who hasn't had kids. And so I have had a partner for many years, and there's a certain stability, but there is another part that isn't normal in my life, or didn't go down the normal way. And so I was looking at my my own life, and I had this image of a tree where I always see my life as a labyrinth, and we take decisions, or life makes decisions for you. So I was thinking, like, the life of like taking decisions, you branch off here, and then you take this decision, and then, you know, go that way, and you end up at the end of the branch. But all the other branches that you didn't take also are in the realm of possibilities of your subconscious. And so I had this sort of idea that I wanted to go into all my past, sort of like a healing with my other me's that are in me that I didn't develop. And so each crossroad, there's a little symbol, and I visualized different parts of my life where I could have gone a different way and I took a different route. And what could have happened if I had gone that way, kind of, I visualized. So it took me 4 years to paint that painting, where I actually did an inner work on myself of sort of reconciling with all the me's that I didn't become, and bringing them. I was into a lot of studying neurology and the mycorrhizal networks. And I was thinking, if and spider webs, I love spider webs. If I was like the little spider who tried to weave in the present all those ends of the tree that I hadn't become to the present, I would have that experience in the present and be more united inside with all of them. I don't know if I can explain, but so that was the tree of possibilities. And so all those little tiny little monsters and faces that were in the background, I asked myself, well, who are they? What are they? And I thought, all those are the influences that are in our subconscious through our education and our surrounding and our culture, and that make us do those decisions, because all that is part of us. That, like, if I was I was in a different culture and I had a different upbringing and I was in a different place, I might have taken different decisions. So your cultural background and everything are like the little tiny voices that tell you, you should do this, you should do that. So that's a bit of the story. Sorry, it's a bit long.
Yeah, didn't see that one coming. I like it though. And, you know, you say that, obviously, there's many different branches that you potentially could have taken in your life, and lots of consideration that went into that over 4 years of creation. But what, you know, you had a very alternative upbringing, really, in Ibiza in the 70s, a very kind of like bohemian lifestyle, shall we say. I mean, how did that influence the kind of artistry that you've perhaps gone on to produce?
I think I had full support in that way. I think my mum never gave, I mean, I was brought up alone with my mum. There wasn't a father. My father died when I was very young. So So really, she was all for it, for the arts. And her friends and surroundings were kind of like family. So I didn't really have a family structure. There was no brothers and sisters or father or cousins. Or like, my Spanish family live in Barcelona and my English family live in England. And I would see my family like once a year or every 2 years. But I didn't have like a daily relationship with them. And I think the people that I was brought up with were like our cousins and extended family. So Christmas and sort of all these celebrations would be very eclectic, people from all over the world and everybody bringing their speciality to the house and sort of get-togethers that way. So I think there was a lot of input of friends of my mum who were artists, writers, photographers. I mean, there were all kinds of people. And so the arts were always there. There was always music, there was always dance, there was always... and that was a big part of it. But I was kind of, I think I grew up a bit too early. I knew everything that was going on. It wasn't as if I was separate from adults. Like, adults and kids were brought up all together and we knew what was going on in every aspect. So I think I was very sort of practical in a way. I had this need to, I've always been supported to express myself artistically, but I didn't really have a support on academics, and I wish sometimes I would have, because there wasn't an appreciation of the school system. My mum couldn't care less whether I was good at school or not. She didn't really believe in the system either. She was a rebel, super rebel. So she thought education was at home, and she was very forward. I mean, I had that kind of education at home, but I went to a regular Spanish school. So sometimes I would complain about things at school and she'd say, oh, you just got to adapt to everything. And, you know, that's what life is like outside. So, yeah. Yeah, it's very different, my education at home and my life at home, than what I saw in school. But then a lot of my friends at school were kind of very like Spanish and from normal working class families, and they weren't the sort of hippie-ish kids. And I think actually I tended to go for stability and I found a lot of people a bit too crazy, and I really sort of kind of went away from things that were too crazy. I didn't find it fun, just, you know, but some people thought, oh, wonderful, someone's got a really colourful life. And I thought, goodness, like, disaster. So I think I grew up a bit too early.
Would you say you picked up on any of your mum's rebelliousness?
Yes, completely, but not in her favour.
In what way?
Well, because, I mean, I was always educated to think for myself, which is a great basis. And so to not always question and always why something. So I think that was very useful, because you're not so easily taken in by certain things, or you have a way of making criteria. I don't know. I think she's always been a rebel. And I've been a rebel in another way. Yeah, I did. I mean, I'm not a rebel sin causa, no? Without a cause. But I think I have a kind of a character. I don't like conflict. I don't like sort of, I'm not sort of, I won't go against something. I would try and be very discreetly, or understand, or try and see how to work on something that I disagree on, or I'm a bit more templada, yeah.
Contemplative?
No, templado, templance. I don't know in English. I think I'm not so confrontative. I've been brought up with sort of ecology ideas and things sort of, but I don't know. Also, I've had discussions with my mum, like, I felt I wasn't a feminist, and she said, come on. And I said, no, I don't feel like I have to prove myself. And she was right, actually, in a way. what my mum went through and other people went through as a rebel, they paved the way for someone like me. I didn't have to rebel against anything. It was just, I was accepted and I felt sure of myself. So I didn't have to fight for my rights in any way. So maybe, yeah, she fought a lot of things before and I had a easier time.
Well, definitely in the 70s. I mean, there was a lot of all of that going on at the time, I think, really. It's quite intriguing. I mean, what was that like growing up as a child here in the 70s in Ibiza?
It was... I mean, when I look back, I can see it was very good. It wasn't all rosy. I think people paint a very rosy picture about it in looking in retrospect. It wasn't so rosy, but it was very real. I would say things were very real. I think we've lost touch with where, like, I was brought up on a very much on a survival level. And so you're completely directly in contact with things that grow and you eat them, and there isn't an economy that comes from I don't know where. Like, if you didn't look after yourself, you didn't eat. I mean, I never was without any food, I'm not saying that, but it was like very primitive in it. I didn't know what was going on in the world with news. I didn't have a TV. We had a little bit of electricity, but there was BBC World Service on a little tiny radio with batteries. I mean, that was the biggest electrical item at home. There was nothing, even if we had electricity, but we didn't have running water. So we had a well, so we had to take all the water out and do all our hand washing by hand. So until I was 12, it was very much, cutting wood, and that's the wood burning stove. So there was nothing came easily. I don't remember free time to kind of wander. And it was always like life was a job. So I am very used to working, probably because my mum was a mum alone and I had to chip in. And it wasn't just chipping in. It was like half in half kind of thing. So, yeah. But I think there was a lot of beautiful things about living here. I mean, the integration that I lived like extranjeros and ibicencos was very beautiful, because we used to sort of be mixed. It wasn't just like, I wasn't like with the people who went to the Mourne Valley school, or who were, they were kind of more in a bubble, I think, because they weren't in a regular Spanish school. And the ones that we did go to Spanish schools, we were always called la extranjera, or we were called, because I would bring Marmite in my sandwiches or things they didn't understand. There were some English things in my culture, obviously, but and my mum was vegetarian, so I would always bring these weird sandwiches with all these pastes you would make, and I just wanted white bread and nocilla, and I wanted sort of normal things that kids would have. And but yeah, I don't know. I think it was a very positive upbringing, and I learned a lot, and I'm very capable with my hands to do a lot of things and work things out. And I think if I wouldn't have had that upbringing, I would be much more sort of, as we call in Ibicenco, un poll de granja. Un poll de granja is a chicken from a chicken factory. It doesn't have any feathers, and that's called, for the people who don't know how to do anything for themselves, who need everything.
Do you see all walks of life on Ibiza and people a little bit like that? But I also see a lot of creative people here, and I think that, you know, the island does seem to attract them, or at least create them. You know, obviously you grew up here, and that kind of lifestyle and that kind of childhood obviously paved the way for your creativity to flourish. And that's something that you also teach other people as well. So how would you say that maybe that, you know, allowed you to kind of find your feet in that world?
Yeah, that definitely was, it was also an experiment. When I started giving some art classes in the afternoon in a regular school, they said, can you come and give some classes to some kids? And I thought, I've never done that before. And I went with a friend, and we did one winter of one day a week in the afternoon, we'd give an art class. And I suddenly discovered like a vocation that I really loved. And also, because I'd been in this sort of spiritual creative school in California for a year, I'd learned a lot of techniques of sort of working on self through art. And I felt it really worked wonderfully with kids. And I started also working with a lot of kids who had trouble concentrating, or kids who were diagnosed with several things, which I don't always agree on diagnosing. But art is really an interesting way of engaging and sort of getting to know themselves. And so I really felt in my essence with that, and I loved it, and I find it is vocational, but it's not vocational as a way, like it takes a lot of energy to work with children, and I found that the perfect balance is like 1 or 2 days a week to do intensive workshops. I enjoy it very much, but if I had to do it like 5 days a week for 7 hours a day, which I have done in a couple of schools, it's exhausting, because then you can't give in the level of quality that you want to give. And I think it's really, I work at it more like sessions. So I think a lot of my upbringing comes through in my classes and the way I work with kids. And yeah, I work on their self-esteem and finding themselves in where they're comfortable and helping them develop. So it's not classes of like a painting still life and getting perfect at seeing views or anything like that. It's to do with creativity, and it's to do with finding games of that will use your subconscious and you'll find inside yourself. So there's a lot of that kind of work, which I also do with adults. But
I mean, would you say that kind of creativity, I mean, how can you kind of bring it through perhaps when you're feeling maybe a little bit stuck? Or, I mean, there's a lot of paintings in this room, and particularly in your art studio, and I've obviously seen exhibitions, and you know, there was a little pause I think for a couple of years in the last few years where you weren't able to create, you're a little bit busy, but I feel like, yeah, you seem to be back on a roll again. I mean, how do you notice in yourself when things are just about to start to come through you again?
For me, art is, I can't help doing art. It's kind of, I have to. And in any way that I can do it, it is kind of like a sanity. It's a way I need to kind of, it's also my time alone with myself, the sort of getting down to base and having a chat with myself, but without having a chat. So yes, for these couple of years that I've had these difficulties and I couldn't paint because I had to take care of other things, I did suddenly, like my little diaries that I always write in and paint and do things, is where I do these scribbles and then I turn them into things. And so I was doing that with kids and I was doing that by myself. And then somebody said, oh, I'll do a scribble. And then what do you turn it into? And then sort of the ball started rolling. And so I decided to do this. I'd realized that actually with 10 minutes turning a scribble into a drawing, I kind of went into my zone, my space, that usually with painting would take me a few hours, where I, you know, you have to have the paint out, and I can't just start painting for like half an hour and then put everything down again. But with just a black pen, ball end pen, and a little notepad in wherever I was, if I was taking my mum to the hospital or I was taking, I could just doodle in my little thing. And so I started collecting people's scribbles and turning them into little beings. And the thing grew and grew and grew, and I've done like 850 of them so far. There's all these booklets full of them. So I realized, without really wanting to, that that was giving me a little bit of sanity. So I think it's always very necessary to keep finding a way, and this is resilience, of being creative, whatever the circumstances. So if I couldn't paint and I couldn't have the space to paint, at least I could draw, or I can write, or I can do something. So I think I will always find a way around, even if I don't do it consciously. And I didn't do it, oh, I got to find something to sort of keep my mind in its space. But it kind of came to me. I was doing it and it felt good. And then I realized, wow, this is actually quite therapeutical. And I have fun. And it's also a way of engaging with a lot of people, because each scribble had to be with a different person. So it was interesting as well to keep in contact with people, even if I couldn't be so sociable and I couldn't see so many people all the time as I was before. So yeah, it's been quite an interesting experiment. I don't know where it's going to go.
That is the number one reason why I make this podcast. We were just talking about this before we started, and I was a bit like, what, you know, sometimes I really do ask myself why I'm doing this, but you know, it gives me the ability to ring up somebody like you and say, hey, would you be up for having a conversation? So thank you for having me in your beautiful studio, and to listen to even half of your stories. Probably not even we haven't even dropped a small pebble in the pond of everything that you've got to talk about, but maybe we'll have to do another one sometime.
I hope it was interesting enough. I don't know. It's like, I mean, I am not the only firefighter or anything like that. I don't want to put it out of context, but
it's beautiful to hear those stories of, you know, what you see. It's a perspective that none of us are privy to or privileged to experience. And I think that it is a privilege to do that kind of work, but also bloody hard.
I think
hard.
It is interesting that if you do podcasts, because your podcasts are in English and it goes out to an English public, English speaking public, at least on the island. And I've realized that in the last 3 years since I've come back to Ibanat, that in the fires that we've had, I've had to be a translator in most of them, because when some fire goes out of hand somewhere, it's on a private property and we have to speak to the owners, and private properties in the countryside are now always either Dutch, English, American, Canadian. They're from all over the place, and not really a lot of Bisingos. I mean, we were counting last summer, it's two pieces of land were from Ibisingos that had fires. All of the others were from different parts of the world. So they pull me out of there and kind of go and translate for the guy who's taking down all the data, has to sort of fill in the papers, and they need somebody who's fluent in both languages to translate and really get them to understand what's happened. So if you did do another program about the fires in summer, during the summer or whatever, I might recommend also somebody you could speak to, higher up from me, that might sort of tell you things that you want to hear that need to get out to the English speaking community that live here.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, thank you so much. I really, really, it's been lovely to be here, and lovely to see you again.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you.
It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.